Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. You know, we don't do many two-part series here on Amazing Tales CT, but this one requires two parts. You simply can't do today's topic justice without splitting it into two. The story is really such a nail-biter, and it has so many interesting twists and turns, and it's one that, frankly, most people I have spoken with have never heard about it before. Now, it did happen more than 100 years ago in Long Island Sound. A submarine with 41 crew members aboard sank off the coast of Fairfield in the year 1921. Well, if you never heard about it, join the club. Here to tell us this riveting story is Michael Bilava. Now, he's a Connecticut-based historian and author of Wicked Bridgeport and Wicked New Haven, and an absolutely amazing storyteller. Michael's going to be along with this story in just a minute. We're not going to do a trivia question this week because, frankly, you already know what's ahead next week. It's going to be part two of this unforgettable story. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients. And they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. Back when I was a youngster, the school I went to went on a field trip to Groton, where we were able to climb down into what was then the recently decommissioned USS Nautilus submarine. Now, I was just a kid. I hadn't grown into adult size, but I still clearly remember thinking that those quarters were just too cramped for me. And those thoughts stuck with me for years afterwards, always wondering what it would be like to be trapped in a sub underwater. Frankly, I found it unthinkable and simply had to turn my thoughts elsewhere. Well, for the next little while, you're going to face this reality head on because our story today is indeed about a sub that sank in the waters off Long Island Sound 100 years ago, a nightmare by any definition. Now, before we get to the story, perhaps you were not aware of Connecticut's amazing history regarding the development of submarines. Now, if you go back to the Revolutionary War, right, we only had sailing ships. Steamships hadn't even been invented. Well, a Connecticut man, David Bushnell, invented something called the Turtle. Now, he was from Westbrook, Connecticut, near Old Saybrook. And what David put together with the Turtle was essentially a round orb. It was big enough for just one person, and that person had to sit on a little seat and pedal the ship forward, had a few hand controls for steering, and there was enough air to be underwater for 30 minutes. Now, George Washington himself helped finance Bushnell's Turtle project because he wanted it to enter New York Harbor in the late 1700s and have a brave Patriot soldier place explosives on the hull of a British ship. It almost worked, but that brave Patriot couldn't quite get the explosives to stick to the ship's hull, and that whole mission had to be aborted. Well, fast forward about 100 years, and Milford resident Simon Lake entered the scene. Lake built the world's first seaworthy submarine right here in Connecticut. Lake went on to run a company in Bridgeport, the Lake Torpedo Boat Company, where he built subs for both scientific exploration as well as for militaries around the world, including the U.S. Navy. Now, today's story is about one of Lake's subs, the S-48. It launched for its maiden voyage from Bridgeport in 1921, but frankly didn't make it too far before it sank. And how and why, you're just going to have to wait to hear. Telling us this absolutely gripping story is a fabulous storyteller, Connecticut-based historian and author Michael Bilava. He wrote a lengthy article on this topic in Connecticut Magazine that I literally could not put down. Michael, let's start off with how you came across this story, because as you and I have discussed before we started recording, it's miraculous that more people don't know about this, that a sub went down in Long Island Sound. How did you happen upon this story?
Going back some years ago, just always have been fascinated with the mystery and the history of Long Island Sound. Been researching chapters for my books, Wicked Bridgeport and Wicked New Haven, the headline from a Bridgeport paper said, S-48 submarine sinks off Bridgeport. And it was a headline that was a screaming off the front of a local Bridgeport, Connecticut paper. And I said, how could I have never heard of a submarine sinking, you know, right off of the state's biggest city? I started researching everything I could about the S-48, created a file, put that file away for a bunch of years, and then as it approached the 100th anniversary of this nautical thriller, I figured now is the time to take that file out, put the story on paper, to share the memory of these heroic gentlemen on board the S-48.
And before we get into the story of what happened that day, I also didn't know until I started doing these podcasts the history of submarine making in Connecticut, going back to David Bushnell and the Turtle, right up to Simon Lake in Milford, and then his torpedo boat company in Bridgeport. I mean, you know, you hear about the Electric Boat Shipyard in Groton, and you think, well, that's submarine manufacturing in Connecticut. That's today, but, you know, long ago, we created all this.
About Simon Lake. Simon Lake was born in New Jersey in 1866. He eventually found himself moving to Connecticut. He'd been thrilled by Jules Verne's story, The 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And just fascinated with that story, he took on a lifelong dream of building some kind of underwater apparatus. And eventually he did. He built in the late 1890s the world's very first operational submarine. So he was a well-known individual in the submersible world, in naval circles. Eventually he moved the Lake Torpedo Boat Company to Bridgeport, and he was in competition with what would become the boatworks in Groton. That was a long, long-standing competition between the two companies. Simon Lake had a hot temper. Simon Lake may have had maybe overrides in some of his manufacturing costs. He blamed a graft of senators having money thrown at them. The long story short was that the Lake Boat Company did not get the government contracts, and eventually they went out of business. But for a number of years, they built a fleet of submarines for governments around the world, and including the U.S. Navy.
So let's turn back the clock, right? And ironically, this is to the day 20 years before Pearl Harbor. So it's December 7th, everybody knows that date, 1921, which is now just a little over a century ago, and the S-48 is going to go out on a trial run. Now, there are a lot of key players in this story, and you lay them all out, but there are two in particular that we'll kind of keep track of as we go through. Captain Joseph Austin, he's a 35-year-old Naval Academy grad who's piloting the boat, and then there's this local boxer, Pete Dunn. We'll get into his exploits as well, and there are many others you'll mention, I'm sure, as we go along this. I thought, let's take this sort of step by step. What they were supposed to do was leave Bridgeport, stay above the surface for the most part, go out to New London. Then when they get to New London, I guess pick up a few others and then go out toward Block Island and do dives in 200 feet of water. And right off the Bridgeport coast by the Penfield Lighthouse, for those who know it, I guess it's more like 70 feet, and Captain Austin is going to do a trial dive there. Let's pick up the story there. What happened?
About 4 miles east of Penfield Reef Light, Captain Austin and the other officers on board, they decided that they would just try a trial run dive. At most 70 feet, perhaps 75 feet of water, will attempt this dive. They announced the dive. The alarm went off twice, dive, dive, and the boat started to submerge. Not a problem. But then all of a sudden, the pressure immediately changed. Their ears were popping, and something was wrong. Their ears were hurting. The boat started to sink rapidly, was what the situation was. Within a few moments, once this was realized, the wheels were turned to stop the salt water from flooding into the outer hull that would safely submerge the vessel. But no, what happened was one of the entrances to the water tanks had been left undone. As the boat went underwater, it began to fill rapidly with the water from Long Island Sound and quickly sank to the bottom. It fell to the bottom aft down, so the stern was resting on the seabed at a slight angle, but well below the surface, 60, 70 feet it had sunk. The rear of the boat, if you could imagine, was dragging along the bottom of Long Island Sound until it hit a massive hole. Like you think of it as a huge divot. And then the hull rested in that hole, in that slot, with a slight angle pointing upward, but well, well below the surface of Long Island Sound. Complete surprise. The men sprung to, you know, their stations to stop the flooding water, but it was far too late. Within 30 seconds, the rear compartments of the boat were filling with salt water.
Now, for those people who are maybe perhaps nautically challenged and don't know fore and aft and stern and bow, let's talk about the front and the back of the submarine. And think about, let's say, like a pencil. And the eraser would be the back end and the flint would be the front end. And what had happened was the eraser, as you say, was dragging along the bottom, hit into this divot. And the flint is pointing a little bit upward, but is well below the surface. So now they are trapped 60, 70 feet of, you know, below the surface in Long Island Sound. And let's get to question number one. Why didn't they just get on the radio and call in for help?
Exactly. It's 1921. The technology does exist. However, the communication devices were not properly installed. For whatever reason, I mean, just gross misconduct on the part of the folks on shore. Things were just perhaps in that one moment taken for granted that it was just a routine exercise. They were going to be heading to New London for the deep sea dives. Perhaps the radio would have been confirmed in New London. I don't know. I really researched. I couldn't find any mention. There really wasn't any explanation. That was going through the naval journals, too.
It is absolutely mind-boggling. What I thought we would do, and your article lays this out almost minute by minute, it's just fabulous. Let's take this in chunks of time. So in the first 35 minutes, and I think this will give people an idea of just how frantic and how quickly things moved against the crew in terms of all the problems that cropped in. Let's start talking first about the electric motors that failed. So the lights start to flicker, and what had caused that to happen?
The batteries for the boat were located below iron panels or iron grids. You could look down and probably see the batteries below the deck. They were exposed. So when the salt water began to enter the lower portions of the ship, we're saying the eraser part of the pencil, the back, that water started to rise. And once it came into contact with the batteries, they started to, of course, shut down the power. And also a terrible, terrible effect of that is that salt water and the acid from those batteries creates chlorine gas, which is the same poisonous gas that was manufactured and used during World War One. And so this poisonous gas, this yellow, greenish, noxious chemical, began to fill the boat. You can't expel the fumes or the gases once they're ensconced inside the boat because there's no air circulation. It stays inside. They had to quickly come to terms with stopping the salt water from hitting the batteries. They then were ripping off their shirts. They were grabbing mattresses and blankets, anything to staunch the water flow and absorb the salt water. Once they could suck up the water with the clothing and material, they could also use, what they did use, were tin coffee cups. And they would take those cups and fill a bucket, and they could put it in an area that would expel the water out of the bilge and into the sound. So they could expel the water. Pumps are also, of course, on all vessels to expel water that comes in through the hull. But because there was no electricity, the majority of pumps weren't working. Luckily, two pumps did stay online. They struggled, but they did help keep up that flow of the water exiting the boat. Problem was, water was rushing in so fast and constant, the men with their clothing, with their tin cups, with the pumps going full tilt, they couldn't keep up. The miracle was that when you had mentioned Pete Dunne, one of the boxers on board, another boxer, Harvey DeLorme, he had boarded the S-48 that morning, you know, walking through the Lake Boat Company's shipyards, and just happened to see this long ravel of tubing, some kind of rubber tubing. He said, "Hey, you never know. This might come in handy." So he picked it up, and he just, you know, he shouldered it, you know, and boarded the submarine. They cut it into sections, and they siphoned the salt water away from the batteries. They made 12 different lines of tubing to get that salt water away. So with the men bailing, the pumps working, struggling to work, but really it was those 12 lines of tubing that took the salt water away from the batteries that kept them from shutting out all the power in the boat and also, of course, filling the boat with chlorine gas. The thing was, every time they dipped their cups, their hands into the pools of water, they were coming in touch with acid, and so they were burning their hands. And the same went with when they started to siphon the salt water away from the batteries. You know, you have to put the end of the tube, one end in the water, and other end, you have to suck that water into your mouth to start the flow. Well, initially, it was hitting their lips and going into their mouths, they're filled with acid. So their mouths, their lips were burned, their hands were constantly being burned, and this went on for, you know, over 12 hours.
So now if you think about Austin, who's in command of this ship, and what they're trying to do with this pencil that's stuck under the water is try and reduce enough weight so that maybe the bow end at least will go up above the waterline. This is kind of the strategy they're going to pursue. So they cut the anchors loose, number one. That doesn't seem to help at all. And then they had a couple of dummy torpedoes on board. And this was interesting because they figured not only would they get rid of them because they were about 2 tons total of weight, but they put messages on the torpedoes and then put some messages in behind them. Could you tell us that part of the story?
Sure. Stuck under the water, 60, 70 feet below the surface, without any means of communication, they started thinking, what could we do to try to announce that we're stuck here under the sound and we're losing air? The boat is filling with poisonous gas. And they somehow painted messages on the side announcing, you know, a submarine sunk, chambers filling with water, send help. They painted those on the side, hoping that once they rippled across the surface, it's going to make a big scene. Somebody somewhere might see it aboard another boat. There were people plying along sound the whole time, unknowingly to anybody, the crew or passengers on these boats, that right below them, the S-48, you know, was in peril. They fired those torpedoes. Nobody did see them. They filled what they did, they took milk bottles, and they wrote personal messages on the milk bottles, and they attached those to the tail ends of the projectiles. And they were hoping that if somebody within a few hours doesn't see the torpedoes, they'll find something floating in Long Island Sound. Nobody found those. Actually, they did turn up months and months later, maybe over a year later. The rusted torpedoes were found. They were not armed, and two of the milk bottles were found. One of the messages was actually penciled by Peter Dunn, the boxer on board who plays a big role in the story of the S-48.
Now, there's another operation that starts at 45 minutes after sinking. Everything we've talked about has been in the first 45 minutes since the sub went down. And now somebody comes up to Captain Austin and says, you know what, we've got a bunch of pig iron on board, about 200 bars, each weighing 50 pounds, and they come up with this outrageous plan. But it helped to get the pig iron off board because they didn't need it, and they figured another way to reduce the weight. Can you explain how that happened?
Sure. They went about disassembling anything they could and putting all the weight in the aft of the boat so they could raise the bow of the submarine above the surface of Long Island Sound. They were ripping the venting, the air ducts, anything that wasn't useful or in use to the back of the boat. The boat really didn't move a bit. They were stumped what to do. But what saved them was the fact that pig iron, these pigs were on board. They're made of lead. And they were positioned throughout the boat to create the weight that would be on board a commissioned vessel, So when they realized they had this movable weight, they decided to create a human chain, and they moved these pig iron bars, man by man, to a chamber that was used for sounding. They'd have the exterior door of this sounding chamber shut, so seawater didn't come in. They'd put the single bar in. They would close the internal door, then open the external door that was on the outside of the hull, and the pig iron bar would drop to the bottom of Long Island Sound. Then they would just repeat the process.
It was 5 tons, so they would have had to do that 200 separate times.
Yes, yeah, and some estimates, Mike, some estimates, they said that it was actually over 5 tons. Everything I read about it, 5 tons kept coming up in the records, but some hinted at even up to 9 tons.
And then within a half hour, they start to feel the bow start to nudge upwards.
The tip of the submarine starts to approach the surface of Long Island Sound.
Well, you may think you've heard the entire story by now, but trust me when I tell you the most incredible parts are yet to come. And those parts, well, you're just going to have to wait until next week's part two. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Now, I don't want to do a spoiler alert at all, but I'll tell you one reason that you should come back for part two, amongst many others. While they were making some progress on positioning the sub's front end to poke above Long Island Sound waters, what you didn't know was that there was a full-fledged storm underway packing gale-forced winds that had struck Long Island Sound as well. We're going to be looking forward to hearing back from our guest again next week, Michael Belavum, Connecticut-based historian, author, and fantastic storyteller. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.